Wohlstand für alle. Spezial.
Hello and welcome, Andrew Elrod.
Hello.
Ja, wie man schon an der Anmoderation merkt, sprechen wir heute nicht auf Deutsch mit einem Interviewgast, sondern wir sprechen heute auf Englisch, da wir nämlich einen Gast haben, der uns aus den USA zugeschaltet ist, der kein Deutsch spricht, der uns sehr viel Interessantes zu berichten hat über die Geschichte der Preiskontrollen, über die er im vergangenen Jahr seine Dissertation abgelegt hat an der University of California und der heutzutage für eine Gewerkschaft an der Westküste arbeitet. Wir sprechen mit Dr. Andrew Elrod. Andrew, I'm very glad to have you here with me today. The last time we talked, a few weeks ago, we were talking about wartime and about inflation and about price controls because I did an interview for Der Freitag, a German weekly. And now a few weeks later, we are experiencing a new war in Europe and we are also seeing very serious discussions about price controls, which is quite surprising because just a few months ago, when Isabella Weber started this entire discussion about price controls, a lot of economists were ridiculizing her. Well, now they aren't anymore, and I'm glad to have you here with me today. So we are going to have quite a lot of subjects to cover today. We need to talk about the theory of price controls. Why are so many economists against it? We need to talk about the history of price controls and, of course, about the question, could price controls help in the economic crisis that might come together with this war, not only in Europe, but in the entire world? So maybe we should start with the theoretical issues. A lot of economists are, or at least a lot of mainstream economists are, against price controls. Why is that?
It's a big question. I guess listeners are probably familiar with the idea that prices serve a kind of signaling mechanism for society. They are one of the primary determinants of profits, and as profits vary across industry lines of production, companies, entrepreneurs, so the theory goes, have an indication about where social priorities lie. So the notion that prices should remain privately controlled, I guess is the word I would use, not controlled by the government through any ceilings or floors, not pegged by the government in any way or fixed by the government. That idea, is rooted in really English, Anglo assumptions about the role of competition and private incentives. So the idea is that if prices increase somewhere, it indicates an increase in demand for whatever that good is for those commodities, and that increase in prices and profits will encourage competitive entrepreneurs to enter that line of business and supply the demand that is driving the price up compete those profits away. So it just in the world of theory, there's a very strong case against controlling prices and a very sound, logical argument to make that if the government does fix certain prices and prevent the increase in profits that accompany an expansion of demand or a change in the composition of demand, so that certain industries are suddenly profiting much more, if the government prevents that from happening, then the entrepreneurs, they won't know where to put their resources. The investors who are giving the loans to the entrepreneurs won't know, who is actually satisfying, the changing composition of the society's, demand for commodities. So, you know, the theory it's a price theory. It was formalized at the end of the 19th century. The English economist Alfred Marshall, I think, is the one who first popularized the graphical depiction of supply and demand schedules, and you know the crossing of supply and demand at a given price and quantity. So, and that price theory has remained kind of core, really canon to what we think of today as academic economics. If there's one thing that you learn in a school economics class, economics textbooks, you know, it's going to be this sort of basic mode of representing, you know, what is in fact a extremely complicated and not as competitive as theory might indicate, but an economic process that you know is extremely complicated and varies by industry. You know, one tool and one reason for the success of the economics discipline is that you know it gives people tools to understand what is actually a highly complex and historically specific configurations of you know production, distribution, consumption, and that sort of stuff. So that's the case against price control, and it's firm, and the reaction to the recent talk among some economists, journalists, and historians who recognize the fact that throughout the history of capitalism, governments have time and again resorted to price control. The sort of scandalized reaction to that acknowledgement is one measure of the sort of the strength of that orthodox price theory.
But of course, what strikes me, I mean, first of all, this entire theory, it makes a lot of sense. So when demand goes up, prices go up, this means that profits go up, which means that production will expand, and then of course supply will meet demand again, and then prices will fall, etc. And if the state doesn't respect these laws and sets a price which is too low, then production won't expand, and then supply won't meet demand, etc. This all makes a perfect lot of sense. But I mean, this is not the situation we are experiencing right now, because we can't just expand production anytime we want. We have global supply chain issues, we have energy issues. So this model, which is making sense in a perfect competitive world, etc., is not what we have right now, right?
There are competitive industries. I guess I wouldn't say that, you know, every market is dominated by a cabal or a conspiracy of oligopoly firms. But it is true that supply takes time to respond. Particularly if you are relying on imported commodities that are outside of the national economy, then the time that it takes could be very long. There could be some barriers to for example, political barriers to accessing an increased supply, and that could drive prices up for a very long time. There was something similar. I mean, this is what happened in the petroleum industry, the global petroleum industry during the 1970s. The developing countries and the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, basically a geopolitical formation, increased the global price of oil because they needed to import more dollar-denominated capital goods, machinery, you know, modernization equipment, and the price of oil quadrupled in a year. You know, so in those situations where a market price increase is unavoidable, societies have other ways of rationing a fixed supply. You know, that's what prices do. The prices are a form of rationing, and they ration to the highest bidder. But if you are in a situation where there's a certain commodity that the public determines that it needs, its members need, and that rationing it on the basis of price is not going to be acceptable, the public won't accept that, you need to find some other ways to do it. And price controls is a sort of initial step to prevent the price increase from happening and therefore ensure a access to, you know, to those on lower incomes who can't afford the market price. And then depending on the duration of the experiment, usually this will pass into rationing, or almost immediately. You can imagine that if you're going to keep prices down, you're going to have to limit the quantity that each individual gets. And something like this is similarly happening, at least in the United States, with like COVID tests, what the English call lateral flow tests. The retailers, they'll only sell you 4, or they'll only sell you 8, or something, because they realize that there's a huge demand here. They're not going to just increase the price to, $200 a test or whatever. I think maybe in England, there is some more price competition. You do get these ridiculously priced tests. In the United States, at least at the major national retailers that I've seen, you know, they've been keeping the price in the $20, $30 range, but they limit how many you can take. And there you can see, privately, the retailers themselves are rationing. They're doing, you know, and that tells you a little bit about the relationship of between price and quantity. You know, in theory, if they were competitive sellers, they would just let the demand for COVID tests dictate a price, and the price would change every day. But our markets are organized in a way to where prices really are fixed by the companies for periods of time. January comes around, everybody adjusts their prices, and then we have that year's prices for a lot of markets. And in that situation, already from the get-go, what you're observing is not a freely moving competitive market. This is the COVID test. This is one example, there are a wide variety of commodities. So maybe if we could, I should ask, you know, is this starting to get at an answer to your question?
Yes, of course. And I mean, I also have some examples. For example, in Germany, when this entire crisis started, the state didn't really think about rationalizing, etc. But the market did. I mean, when I went into Kaufland, so a supermarket here in Germany, a very famous one, I couldn't buy as much butter as I wanted to. I mean, just as you said, they might have said, we are just gonna sell butter at high prices, and anybody who wants to buy it and has enough money to do so can do it. They didn't. They had the prices fixed, and they said, okay, anybody who wants to buy butter, you can, but you can only take, I don't know, like 5 pieces of butter or something. So this is pretty much what happened here. And what we experienced in the 20th century, right, in Europe and in the United States, is that it wasn't only markets who were trying to impose prices, but also the state. The state tried to impose price controls, for example, during wartime to keep inflation low, right?
Yes, yeah. So, you know, the conceptual move that many of the theorists of price control made in the early 20th century, really the first half of the 20th century, among whom, you know, a writer like John Kenneth Galbraith, the American economist, is probably the most famous and successful. The conceptual move is to say, yes, we accept price theory. We understand, the way prices, quantities, profits should operate, but we observe in our actual organized economy a different behavior. And once you, if you can make the, if you can accept the fact that private firms already exercise a degree of discretion over their prices, then the case against price control starts to weaken, because you start to see that it's not, you know, market forces alone which are determining the availability and the terms of access to commodities, but sources of power, private power, and industries, people who control industries, almost always some sort of private power based on private property, and that's, you know, that power can then become subject to the state, to public intervention through the instrument of the state. Since we're talking about history, one of the big arguments that emerged after World War II, really during the war, but it came to hold a very strong position in the rhetoric of the Cold War that followed, was that the nature of many of the states that had imposed price controls during the 40s during the Depression, those states were not democratic states. They didn't represent any form of public that, group that called themselves the free countries during the Cold War, that they would recognize. And so that argument that, you know, the state itself is kind of untrustworthy, became very influential among American writers, at least. And so the example, you know, it was like, well, who controls prices? It's Stalin's Russia. It's Mussolini in Italy. These are not democratic states, and therefore price control itself is, you know, the kind of power that can be abused by the totalitarian governments. It was the Cold War. It's not true that only states without elections control prices. There are plenty of states that have elections that impose price controls.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the United States, France, for example, Leon Blum in France. So, I mean, let's look at one of those states. Maybe let's talk about the U.S. At first.
Sure.
I mean, you had price controls during the Second World War, during the Korean War, but was it only an instrument used in wartime? Or?
Well, even before the World War, even before World War One, in the United States at the end of the 19th century, the problem of the railroad corporations was a dominated national politics in a way that today in the United States people talk about healthcare in similar terms. You know, there's these corporate hospital corporations buy up all the hospitals, they set the hospital prices, they they bilk the government Medicare programs. They're taking up one-fifth of GDP. You know, the healthcare industry is this major problem in the United States. 150 years ago, the railroad corporations occupied a similar position. And, you know, the railroad rates can really determine the health of a community that's dependent on access to freight transportation, and much of the United States in the 19th century was agricultural. And if you were in a town or near a town, you know, the price that the railroad corporation charged you to ship your wheat or your hogs or whatever it is that you were growing would determine your income. And so entire communities could be displaced because of preferential railroad practices. And so in response to this, throughout the 1870s, there were debates in the Congress about what to do about the railroads. Many state governments passed their own state-level rate regulations fixing railroad rates. And finally, in the 1880s, the Congress, the federal government responded by establishing the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was a federal commission, a regulatory agency that set rates for the railroad corporations nationally, the idea there is usually talked about in terms of public utility regulation. You know, the idea that a certain type of industry, water, electricity, transportation, holds what was then called a natural monopoly, and sometimes this language survives today, but something like heating gas for a city. You know, it doesn't make sense to have a competitive market there, because you're going to end up overbuilding the infrastructure. You're going to have, 10 different companies running gas lines under the same street. It doesn't make any sense. So you end up with a company that holds a monopoly position, at which point, the city government or the state or something is going to step in and start to regulate it, because the public is not going to accept privately determined utility rates.
You still have the state bodies until today, right? I mean, you still have public utility commissions, right?
Yes. Yeah. There are many state public utility commissions in the United States. The Interstate Commerce Commission was dismantled under the Clinton administration in the 1990s. So there's no Interstate Commerce Commission anymore. But that's partially unique to what happened in the United States during the Cold War, which was the expansion of the interstate highway system. So for much of the, from the 30s, beginning in the 30s, which we'll get to in a minute, but beginning in the 30s, the jurisdiction of the Interstate Commerce Commission was expanded to include motor carriers, trucking. And so the Interstate Commerce Commission not only fixed railroad rates, but fixed trucking rates for 50 years. Part of the reaction to the inflation of the 70s in the United States was the idea that such kinds of rate regulation exacerbated inflation. They made inflation worse because they fixed rates. They didn't allow competitors to come in and compete down prices, offering service, more cheaply priced services. So then the Interstate Commerce Commission became a kind of symbol of this diagnosis that, the state was protecting these uncompetitive firms and making inflation worse. So the motor carriers were deregulated in 1980, really, the end of the Carter administration, and then finally in the 90s, the Interstate Commerce Commission itself was abolished. I think that's kind of unique to our transportation infrastructure here in the United States. Just to get back to the question of price control itself, the public utility idea. There's no reason to apply it only to something like railroads, and after the onset of the Great Depression, the depth and the duration of the unemployment crisis prompted the Congress and intellectuals and leading politicians. In the early 30s, to really embrace the idea of national planning. So the New Deal in the United States actually begins with a national price control experiment. the one of the first things the Franklin Roosevelt administration does is request a law, the National Industrial Recovery Act, that it gets from the Congress, which authorizes it to license firms for the imposition of what they called codes of fair competition. So the first 2 years of the New Deal are an experiment in price fixing, and the Roosevelt administration set up over 500, it was like 550 code authorities, each for an industry, and it was minute. It was everything from automobiles, a huge industry, to brassiere wire, like the metal wire that would go into women's underwear. There was a code authority for that, and it would be a board comprised of members of the industry, members of the public, government officials, and then most controversially, members of labor, So every industry suddenly now had a code authority where workers could elect representatives of their own choosing. But then the powers of the code authority were to set prices, set quantities, set wages, fixed. It was a form of legalizing cartel behavior under the idea that this was necessary to stabilize industry, to restore business confidence. That was a very prominent argument, is that investors would not provide capital to these industries unless they knew that they were going to remain profitable, and you could guarantee profits through cartel behavior. And that was the experiment that is, was the National Recovery Administration, the NRA. Today, you try to teach this to students, and everybody thinks you're talking about the gun lobby, because the National Rifle Administration is, the NRA. But in the New Deal, the NRA was a price control experiment. It was declared unconstitutional in 1935. But this is only 6 years before the return of price control with the onset of World War II. So even before war, in the United States, a thoroughgoing engagement with the idea of having prices determined by forces other than just the private corporations themselves. And similarly, in France, under the Blum government, I think in 1936 it was, the French established a price control law, which remained on the books until Mitterrand in 1983. The entire duration of what we think of as the 30 glorious years in France occurred in an era with price control. And economists often look back on this and they say, how could it be that the French had maximum employment and price stability? What was happening? And no one recognizes the fact that prices were controlled. The finance ministry in France had an office, a general commission on price, a price commission, which had the authority to intervene in pricing if it considered any firm or industry to be engaging in sort of profiteering behavior. It could move in and declare a ceiling. It wouldn't have to go back to the parliament to ask for authority. That authority remained on the books. In the United States, it wasn't like this. After World War II, there was a huge lobbying campaign by organized manufacturers to repeal the price control law. They succeeded in 1946. The law expired. The agency that it authorized, where the economist John Kenneth Galbraith had worked, the agency was defunded. Some of its responsibilities were given to the Federal Trade Commission, a different agency, but it ceased to exist. And then, so 4 years later, when the Korean War begins, this debate it plays out differently than it would in other countries, because now the Truman administration has to go back to Congress, ask for a new law. There's an entire opportunity for organized interest to try and influence the Congress to shape the law. Who is it going to apply to? What industries are going to be exempt? It's extremely, highly pressurized, because if you hear that the Congress is about to pass a law that is going to empower the government to control incomes, you want to make sure that your income gets favorable treatment. It's fairly similar to taxes in the way that loopholes are written into the income tax code, at least in the United States. During the Korean War, there was price control. The Truman administration succeeded in getting the authority. The experience, however, was much less consensual than it was during World War II, and those authorities expired in the early years of the Eisenhower administration. And there hasn't been a similarly expansive and thoroughgoing effort at price control since the Korean War. But as far as the history of inflation goes, there is one third occasion, which is the Nixon administration. So in the 1960s, the United States escalated its war in South Vietnam. Really, the escalation takes place in 65, and it is accompanied by an accelerating inflation. You have then it was like 3%, and journalists were tearing their hair out, saying, "Oh my God, this is such a terrible inflation." It's kind of humorous now to realize how slow that inflation was. But in the late 1960s, the Johnson administration finds itself committed to this war in South Vietnam, but also unable to tell the public the nature of its commitments, in part because of the anti-war movement is increasingly vocal, is putting thousands of people into the streets by the end of the decade. And as the inflation begins, Johnson is talking to both his economic advisors and his friends that he made throughout his career in the Senate, who are they sit on the boards of the major industrial corporations, people like George Brown of Brown and Root. They're telling him, Vietnam's like Korea, it's another war in South Asia. During Korea, we imposed price controls. And Johnson is saying, we can't impose price controls because that's going to signal that we're going to stay in South Vietnam for the long run. And we know that we can't do that because we're planning under the assumption that the Vietnam War is going to end in a few years. The last U.S. soldiers don't leave South Vietnam until 1975, 10 years later. But as this is starting, he recognizes that if he's going to ask the Congress to shift the legal basis of government regulation to a war footing and authorize price controls, impose wartime taxes, that it's going to be a signal to the public that now the United States is starting what could be World War III. And that was really during the Korean War, that was really the language people used. They said, "Oh, this is World War III." And Johnson didn't want to do that. So in 1966, the Democrats lose at the midterms. There's a variety of reasons. Most historians draw attention to the recent passage of the Civil Rights Act, and they say the 66 midterms is evidence of a white working class racial backlash. People are against integration. They start voting against the Democrats. And there's truth to that, but I think historians have not given enough attention to the fact that the inflation is getting underway and the Johnson administration has no plan. Very clearly, they're asking for wage restraint. They're going to organized labor and saying you have to keep your wage demands to a government guideline at a time when inflation is going above the guideline. So they're telling the organized working class of the country, what is our plan to stop inflation? Well, it relies on you, workers, to accept that your real incomes are going to fall. And of course, that was unpopular. So the Democrats lose in the 66 midterms. In 68, Johnson doesn't even run. Nixon comes in. And throughout this period, there's an active debate about how to control inflation. The Johnson administration had relied on these voluntary guidelines, which weren't working. So when Nixon comes in, he says, we're not going to do any kind of guidelines. We're not going to tell private businesses, unions. We're not going to tell unions how to do their business, how to go about bargaining. We're going to let it's a free country. It's a free market. We're going to let freedom, determine the outcome. But we're going to impose austerity. We're going to stop government spending. And that's what the Nixon administration does in 1969 when it comes in. And the result is what we today remember as stagflation. You have a turning wage price spiral. You have workers trying to keep up with the rate of inflation. You have firms in a military boom raising prices. You have a government that has signaled that it's not going to control anything. And then you have civilian spending cut back dramatically. So all of the Great Society stuff, all this stuff is pared back. And the civilian share, the government share of GDP for non-military purposes at the end of the 60s falls. So there's a real austerity that's going on. And the public doesn't like this either. So in 1970, the 1970 midterms, the Republicans lose. The Democrats get these huge majorities because it's clear that austerity is not an acceptable way to fight inflation. So it's in this context that the last experiment in price control happened. Then Richard Nixon, you know, the self-proclaimed candidate of business, spent part of his career as a corporate lawyer on Wall Street, always talking about freedom. He realizes that if he's going to stay in the White House in 1972, that they have to the administration is going to have to figure out some way to reduce unemployment, return to economic growth, and do so in a way that doesn't exacerbate the inflation. And the model for doing this, the historical memory for when this has been possible in the United States are periods of price control and periods of war. The Democratic Congress is actually where the authorities for this begin. They pass a law in 1970 authorizing the government to control prices. They after the midterms, they reauthorize those powers. It's always on like a 3-month basis, you know. After the Democratic landslide in the 1970s midterms, they reauthorize those powers, and then it becomes clear that Nixon he's not sure what to do. He calls the Democratic Party leadership's bluff and imposes price controls in August of 1971. And that experiment lasts for about 18 months. It doesn't include the kind of independent bureaucracy that the Korean War and the World War II controls relied on. Each of those was, something like 75,000 to 90,000 officials in World War II. This was augmented by about 350,000 volunteers at the community level. You know, they would go to the store if someone was violating the price ceiling. They would, the volunteers would report it back to a regional office where the government employees worked, and then they would try. There was an enforcement division. There's all these you would get there's lawyers there. The Nixon controls didn't set up a bureaucracy like this. The Nixon controls relied on the IRS, the tax agency, and they put a new code in the corporate income tax, which regulated corporate profits. And so they repurposed the IRS to do this. The jury, I guess, is out basically on the effect of this, in part because the history was so quickly cast aside as evidence of failure and incompetence. But the record does show that prices stabilized in the second half of 1971 and for the duration of the presidential campaign in 1972. Inflation was brought under control, and it worked politically. Nixon wins in a landslide in 1972. So. So that's really the last experiment. The judgment that it was a failure is rooted in the year after the election. So in November of 1972, the election happens. Nixon wins in a landslide. January of 1973 comes around, and the administration, Nixon, Treasury Secretary George Shultz, announced to the public, we're going to make the price control program voluntary. There's no longer going to be any kind of compulsory, oversight to ensure adherence to the price controls. The year 1973 is going to be a year of decontrol, in which the price guidelines are now voluntary. And the result was that during the year of 1973, inflation returned. at the end of the year, they had gotten it back down to 2% or something. I think in 1973 it goes back up, 5-6%. And then at the end of the year, the Yom Kippur War happens in Israel and Syria and Egypt. And by December, the first OPEC embargo happens. And so this inflation that has been unleashed by the Nixon administration's decision to return controls to a voluntary basis, that inflation then accelerates with the oil price shock at the end of the year. So in 1974, you know, there's really a what we think of as the sort of the dreary, austere, social conflict of the 1970s. You know, the doldrums of the 70s is really rooted in this 1974 recession, 1974-75, which till that point it was the deepest. Unemployment gets up to like 10%. It's the deepest recession since the Great Depression. And for somebody, you know, who is, you know, 45 or something in 1975, they had lived through the Depression as a child. You know, so there's a memory there about, you know, the weaknesses of American capitalism. So just to give another example, you know, in 1975, Time magazine runs a cover that's, you know, that has a picture of Adam Smith, and it says, you know, is this the end for capitalism or something? You know, just like a kind of, today we think this is ridiculous, but the crisis was real, and you know, journalists and somewhere like Time magazine would write stories about it. So you know, that's the last experiment. There are various forms of industry-specific rate regulation relying on similar public utility principles, but as far as the kind of total encompassing economy-wide authority to control prices, it doesn't exist in the United States right now.
But you do still have those local public utility commissions, right?
Yes, yeah, states have public utility commissions that regulate certain utilities like water, gas, electricity. And then the other one that we have a lot in the United States are municipal city government laws fixing maximums for rent, housing rent. The major city, New York City, LA, major cities have these on the books, and it's an area of political life in the United States that is seeing new energy because housing is you know, underbuilt. There's a homelessness crisis, and so local elections in many cities now are, this is an issue in local elections, whether they should establish their own, you know, new rent control authorities.
Mm-hmm. So isn't it kind of ridiculous, because a few months ago we had this discussion starting with Isabella Weber's article in The Guardian, and everybody was freaking out, but now you're telling us that you do still have democratically controlled prices in the United States, and not any prices, but really important prices like the cost of living, energy, etc., water, public utility commissions. So why are people not aware of this, of the fact that the state is in fact already participating in a very strong way when it comes to setting prices?
Well, I mean, a big one is oil. In the United States, you know, we have electricity in our homes, but a major energy cost is individual commuting, gasoline. And the Nixon controls, you know, the experience of the 1970s was one in which the federal government moved over the oil industry and fixed the price of petroleum. And there were shortages. Gasoline shortages happened. Refining capacity, the amount of raw crude going into refineries in the United States fell during the 1974 recession, which is like, you know, it doesn't happen. Like the increase can slow, but for actual refinery input to decline is like a clear, you know, sign that the economic activity is declining. You know, it was a deep recession, and you know, people who are in controlling positions in many American institutions today, you know, they're in their late 50s and they're in their 60s. They lived through the 70s, and they've internalized this lesson that, you know, what happened during the 70s is that the government tried to control prices, shortages resulted, everybody was worse off. And of course, we're not going to try this again. And they sort of dismiss it out of hand without really studying what happened. You know, and so in some ways, we're at the mercy right now of this generational cohort. But I would say the short one brief answer is the oil industry. You know, the oil industry in the United States has this tremendous power because everybody drives their cars everywhere. That's starting to change as the oil companies themselves have reimagined themselves as energy companies, and they sort of see the writing on the wall about climate change and decarbonization. So, you know, it's starting to change. But you know, the other part of this is, the other part of this is, the fact that the Congress is going to have to authorize an expansion of any kind of power like this on the federal level. You know, what we're talking about, you know, the price of electricity is a state government, but a big industry like oil, you know, it has to be regulated nationally. It relies on the U.S. Congress, and whether the U.S. Congress represents the will of the U.S. people is really something in contention right now. The jury is out on whether or not the Congress represents the public. So that, you know, that's another problem.
But I mean, those discussions, for example, in Europe are getting really serious. I mean, even the European Commission, which really, I mean, you can't say that the European Commission is not business friendly enough or anything, huh? That this would be ridiculous. And even they are thinking about cutting gas prices, for example, now. So let's say that more and more countries during this crisis that is coming up right now, and that which might be severe, more and more countries are discussing price controls. How would this be possible? Because, I mean, this entire infrastructure, this bureaucratic infrastructure, let's say that the United States said in the 40s and 50s, doesn't really exist anymore, right? Or in Europe, I mean, in Europe, for example, you said that into the 1980s in France, you had price controls. But what about this infrastructure? Would this be possible to just reimpose price controls easily? I mean, there are also some advantages, right? Because, for example, nowadays we are living in the digital age. Maybe it might be easier to monitor prices, etc. So, I mean, I see some problems, like you don't have the old infrastructure anymore, but at the same time, some opportunities that we didn't have, let's say, 70, 80 years back.
I wouldn't say that the problem of bureaucratic capacity or institutional capacity, meaning, you know, the size of the bureaucracy, is really a problem, or ever was. It's true. It might take fewer people now because we can monitor prices in a more efficient way. We don't need entire offices of people, you know, doing paperwork to track an industry. That's true, but I don't think that was ever really a barrier. The barrier is always political. There's somebody who has there are. You know, people who control industries. There are the stockholders of that industry. There are senior managers whose incomes rely on the health of that industry. And those people have political influence. So what's happening, you know, I'm not an expert on European politics. And I wouldn't know, you know, whether the commission or the national governments, you know, I wouldn't know how they would divide or share responsibility for something like a return to you know, price regulation. But I can say that the fact that people are talking openly about it signals to me a change in the attitude of the people who control the industry. So the energy companies themselves, the energy companies themselves are realizing, you know, that they, you know, maybe it's not the end of the world if their control of access to natural gas, to petroleum products, is something they have to share with government. You know, maybe it is that, you know, among the other industries, there is a recognition that, you know, this this is a real, you know, this energy, this coming energy shock, or this current energy shock we're in is a real problem, and that, you know, what is usually, or what has been for much of the second half of the 20th century, a kind of united front of business against public, you know, intervention, maybe this united front can start to break up a little bit, and the oil interests, you know, maybe we can realign against them in some way. But what I'm saying is that at root, it's a political problem. It's about which organized interests are going to acquiesce in having their incomes controlled, which configuration of organized interests are going to impose that control of incomes, and what is the resulting distribution of income going to be? Because if Europe were to not control prices and allow the industry to suddenly start making, you know, 150% returns on investment or something like that, and the price of energy for people across Europe were to go up, that would be a redistribution of income. You know, from the public, the broad public, everyone that uses energy to the energy companies. And so, you know, maybe another way to look at what's going on is people in controlling positions in business and the government realizing that that kind of redistribution is politically unacceptable.
And one last question. Are you hopeful that maybe this entire discussion about price controls might also unleash a broader discussion about democratic planning once again, like in the 1930s?
Yes. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic broke through a logjam on government spending, which now the war in Ukraine for, I guess, you know, unfortunate reasons has continued. You know, government spending is back on the table in a way that it seemed impossible, you know, just 5 years ago. And once, you know, that door is open, there's a lot of questions that become possible. So, yeah, so I am interested to see how, you know, we will respond. I look forward to, you know, to continuing to talk about it with people like you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So to all our listeners, anybody who wants to keep track of what Andrew's doing, you can follow him on Twitter, Andrew Elrod, and see what he's writing, what he's publishing, where he's with whom he's talking, etc. Apart from that, of course, we also thank our listeners for listening to us, and we are always very glad if they support us financially. And of course, thank you for being here with us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
Das war Wohlstand für alle. Ihr könnt uns finanziell unterstützen über paypal.me/Ole und Wolfgang oder über die in der Beschreibung angegebene Bankverbindung. Herzlichen Dank.